Hello, this is Wendy Bauer reading to you today from the Decatur Herald and Review. It's November 7th, 2016. And we'll begin on the front page of today's paper, an article by Tony Reed, Herald and Review staff writer, Cottoning On to Life's Possibilities, A Retiree's Model Behavior. This is from Decatur. The boy from Alabama cotton farm, who learned how to make outboard engines roar and built tires in Decatur until the factory ran out of road, is now ready to take a fantasy ride on a tabletop stagecoach. There's a lot to unpack here, but then Jerome Allen Bailey has managed to jam an awful lot into his 83 years of frenetic existence. A little stiff in the joints these days if he stands too long, but still wiry of frame and full of spark, he proudly points to a tabletop tableau in his Decatur living room of an old West stagecoach pulling up to its stop, surrounded by desert scenery. There are rattlesnakes in the brush, a lone wolf howling, and guys with shotguns on the coach. The team of four horses is elaborately hitched with real leather reins, and all the harnesses were hand-cut and crafted by Bailey. He explains he's got a daughter who lives in Colorado, and he loves the desert scenery, and he's long been fascinated by the Wild West in the days when it was a frontier and men lived by their wits and died by the gun. He's just finished, after taking 2.5 months to put the 2-foot-square tableau together, using a stagecoach model he paid $190 for in 1997, and horses he found in Walmart 15 years ago. Bailey may not get rolling with things right away, but he moves at the gallop when he's ready to go. And apart from the store-bought stagecoach, horses, and some props, everything else is pretty much made from scratch by him. That includes the painstakingly detailed log building that is the stagecoach rest stop, accurate down to the gritty dust clinging to its weathered woodwork. "I just got it all out of my mind," said Bailey, explaining that his imagination provided all the desert topography too. "It was just like when the Lord created the earth. He didn't start with anything either." God, presumably, had the benefit of two eyes during the creation process. Bailey has had to make do with one, his left, since losing his right in a nasty, broken screen door return spring accident at the age of 4. And yet, when it comes to historical accuracy, the discerning eye will see no faults in Bailey's hand-wrought work. The leather harness gear pulling that mini Wells Fargo coach achieves a level of precision you can take to the bank. Bailey explains that the 300-acre farm he was born on, down in the land of cotton-used mules, not vehicle, in the land of cotton-used mules, not vehicles, and he'd grown up watching his daddy harness them for work every day. "Thing is, I didn't want to stay on the farm. I wanted to do something different," he says. "So I did." He hitched himself to a trade school in the rock and roll 1950s and learned to diagnose, fix, and tune outboard boat engines and worked all over the country doing that. "The biggest thing they had in the 1950s was 25 horsepower," he says with a smile. "Later, the biggest thing I worked on had 300 horsepower and was a V8. I'd go to the lake and hang on the side of the boat to work on them." He's never quite managed to get gasoline out of his bloodstream and still takes in the occasional ailing outboard, even now. "He's so good you can tell what's wrong just by listening to it," says his friend, Gloria Starbody, 70, and he's got a lot of patience. He did, however, become a little impatient with not making the money I wanted to make while being sunk up to his elbows in other people's outboards, and that prompted him to go to work for Firestone in Georgia in 1981, always doing engine repair on the side. By 1986, he was transferred way up north to the then Bridgestone Firestone tire plant in Decatur, where the man for all seasons did a little bit of everything. I was a mechanic, I was an electrician, I was a machinist and a pipe fitter and a millwright, he says, pride rolling like a stagecoach along the rising and falling cadence of his Alabama accent. I was a four-star maintenance man. Then came retirement in 2001 amid the pain of the factory closing. Strikes and accusations the plant had produced defective tires linked to some 200 deaths provided a grim run-up to the final shutdown that put 1,500 workers out of a job and blew an economic hole below Decatur's waterline. Bailey remembers colleagues who, like himself, took tremendous pride in the job, and he firmly believes they were scapegoated over the defective tires. We built good tires, and Decatur had a good workforce, he says. But Firestone needed to close a plant, and they chose Decatur. It was all bitter at the time, but the trail dust of acceptance has a way of settling down over the years and smoothing over such tribulations from the past. And Bailey says in the end, you ride on looking toward new horizons. He's always enjoyed keeping those talented hands of his busy, and after the success of the Old West scene, says he may discover new visions he'd like to make real in miniature. The Lord has guided my hand in everything I've done, he says. We'll see what comes next. And a number of pictures accompany this article. One shows Jerome Bailey with the entire scene. He worked over a two-month period to create this desert stagecoach tableau. And an article from the AP, FBI, email probe nets no charges. In a letter sent Sunday, FBI Director James Comey told Congress that a review of newly discovered Hillary Clinton emails has not changed our conclusions from earlier this year that she should not face charges. Sent within 48 hours of Election Day, the letter appeared to resolve any lingering ambiguity over the prospect that the Democratic presidential nominee could yet face a criminal indictment over her use of a private email server as Secretary of State. Based on our review, we have not changed our conclusions that we expressed in July with respect to Secretary Clinton, Comey wrote to congressional leaders, less than 2 weeks after first telling them about a cache of newly found emails that investigators thought might be pertinent to their investigation. But the letter left unresolved other questions, including the content and number of new emails, and how many of the messages investigators reviewed were duplicates of emails they had already seen. The growing number of unanswered questions demand explanations. Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa, the Republican chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said. The letter also drew fresh criticism from lawmakers who said the new email review, announced in a vague letter to Congress, shouldn't have been made public so close to the election. The FBI had been under pressure to reveal additional details about its new email review following Comey's abrupt disclosure on October 28th that the Bureau had discovered emails that were potentially relevant to the Clinton investigation. The emails were found on the computer of Anthony Weiner, the disgraced congressman and estranged husband of Clinton aide Huma Abedin. Weiner is under investigation by federal authorities for online communications he had with a 15-year-old girl. Upon discovering emails thought to be potentially pertinent to the Clinton email investigation, Comey advised Congress that investigators would review the messages to see whether any were classified. The FBI subsequently obtained a warrant to begin the process of going through the emails. That disclosure, made over the objections of the Justice Department, roiled the presidential race in its final days and revived an issue that the Clinton campaign thought had ended over the summer when the investigation closed without charges. In July, the FBI chief chastised Clinton for her use of a private email server, but said the Bureau would not recommend criminal charges against the Democratic presidential nominee or her aides. The Justice Department accepted that recommendation. In his letter to Congress on Sunday, Comey said the FBI had reviewed all new emails to and from Clinton and that nothing had changed its July conclusion. But the letter did not address how the messages wound up on Wiener's computer and what, if anything, the announcement means for Abedin. Abedin's attorney has said she learned from media reports about the discovery of the emails on Wiener's laptop and did not know how they got there. Comey has already said that investigators found classified emails on Clinton's server and that although Clinton and her aides had been extremely careless in their handling of classified information, there was no evidence that anyone had willfully broken the law. The October 28th letter did not automatically increase the chances that anyone was in renewed danger of criminal prosecution, even if additional classified messages were found. We were always confident nothing would cause the July decision to be revisited. Now Director Comey has confirmed it. Clinton campaign spokesman Brian Fallon said Sunday on Twitter. And moving to the local page. City budget details to be revealed today. This is by Chris Lusvardi, Herald and Review staff writer from Decatur. City staff will be providing details of next year's budget to the community for the first time during today's City Council meeting. A study session is scheduled to discuss the proposal, which would be on track to be finalized next month. No increases are expected to balance the budget, said Billy Tyus, assistant city manager. He said Friday that actions taken throughout the past year have put city staff in a position to avoid any significant increases. During its budget process, the council last year approved raising the hotel use tax and utility tax, while later raising its property tax levy and adding a local gas tax. At this point, Tyus said projects will not need to be postponed to balance the budget for 2017. He expects the property tax levy to remain the same. We're attempting to only ask for what is needed to continue city operations, Tyus said. Covering the more than $40 million cost of sewer repair and maintenance could have an impact on the budget, with adjustments needed to meet U.S. Environmental Protection Agency requirements. A funding proposal could be made this winter for that project as the city awaits final information from the agency, Tyus said. He said the city will need to adjust to the ongoing costs of the required maintenance. We've been preparing going forward because we knew we had things coming, Tyus said. Part of the adjustments has been to control spending, Tyus said. City Manager Tim Gleason said during the October 17th council meeting he asked department heads to reduce each of their budgets by 5%. In other business, the council will be asked to consider acceptance of a $333,000 contribution from the Howard G. Buffett Foundation to provide most of the funding needed for the next phase of the city-owned fiber network. Tyus said agreements with the Illinois Department of Innovation and Technology would provide what is needed for the construction, management, and maintenance for the project, as the city provides a connection to the Illinois Century Network Hub at Richland Community College. And the sidebar notes, if you go, the city council meeting is at 5:30 p.m. today in the council chambers, third floor, Decatur Civic Center, 1 Gary K. Anderson Plaza. Also from the local page, education column by Valerie Wells, Herald and Review staff writer. LSA launches egg science class with all eyes on incubator with eggs. From Decatur. The LSA High School's new agriculture science class is eagerly awaiting a blessed event. At the back of the room, in an incubator, are 24 chicken eggs due to hatch about November 17th. Teacher Seth McMillan ordered the eggs from a company called My Pet Chicken. Along the wall behind the incubator are posters showing the various normal and abnormal conditions of eggs, the development of the embryo from day one through hatching, and how to grade the chickens once they're born. Other than figuring out which ones are roosters, because they can't keep roosters due to their crowing, McMillan said the grading poster is only for information purposes. The chicks won't be disposed of if they're less than perfect. Part of what I'm trying to accomplish is trying to teach these kids where food comes from, McMillan said. Trying to teach the whole farm-to-table aspect of it from production to marketing. One big item on the school's wish list is a greenhouse, so the students could grow crops year-round, such as strawberries and tomatoes. That's still in the future, but McMillan plans garden plots for the spring to give them a taste. This is just kind of a lesson in it, he said. We're going to raise these chickens and they're going to produce eggs, but I don't know if we're going to get enough eggs to really sell. The students studied chicken species and chose barred rock and buff Orpington chickens. They're docile, said James Brown, a junior. The chickens will spend a few days in a brooder after they hatch before they move outdoors to a shed that will serve as their coop. Callie Walker, a freshman, comes from a family that keeps livestock, so this is nothing new. She hopes to combine animals and science as a career, though farming is not what she has in mind, she said. The agriculture program is new this year, and so is the school's FFA chapter. All the students in the ag class are also in FFA. McMillan said that while county schools, such as Maroa, Forsyth, and Mount Zion, have ag programs, kids who live in the city of Decatur have little access to such programs. The hope is that the LSA offering will appeal to families who want their children to have that background. Because the chickens will probably be the only live animal project students can do, McMillan is trying other hands-on projects that will help them understand that farm-to-table concept, such as showing them cuts of beef and how to determine good ones. At least, he said, that will give them a life skill for when they're doing their own grocery shopping. I have two students who are going to do supervised agriculture experience projects, McMillan said. That's where they keep records on how they take care of the chickens and their daily chores, that type of thing, and they can get awards in FFA for that. And the two pictures that accompany this article show Callie Walker and James Brown standing by the egg incubator. They are students in the new agriculture science class taught by FFA advisor Seth McMillan at LSA High School. And then a close-up of the incubator. Students are observing the chicken eggs incubation process in the ag class. And the Government and Politics article is by Allison Petty, Herald and Review staff writer. Sanitary District eyes property tax increase. From Decatur. With an eye on state lawmakers and federal regulations, the Sanitary District of Decatur is adjusting its plans for a property tax increase next year. The district's operating expenses are primarily covered by user fees, which bring in about $14.5 million. Property taxes, about $3.5 million this year, largely cover maintenance and upgrades to the district's facilities. District leaders maintain a 10-year plan for both revenue streams, with the idea that moderate, consistent increases are better than sudden, dramatic spikes. The original projects would have had the district increase its property tax levy by $77,000 this year, but Executive Director Ken Newton recommended instead a proposal that would increase the levy by about $320,000. Correspondingly, the district would not increase user fees as much as projected, so it would receive about the same amount of money. Other options Newton presented included continuing as originally planned or shifting its full debt payment, about $1.3 million, from the user fees to property taxes. Newton recommended the third option as a middle ground. It's a putting our toe in the water kind of approach, he said. Newton's proposal stems from the possibility that state lawmakers might enact a property tax cap or freeze, which would inhibit the district's ability to levy or repay debt. That's a concern because district leaders believe they will be required to make expensive upgrades in the coming years to reduce the amount of phosphorus discharged from the plant. A concentration of nutrients in the Gulf of Mexico, sometimes called the Dead Zone, has led the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to launch efforts to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus that are discharged into the Mississippi River. As a result, the district could be required to invest in ways to reduce the nutrients it discharges. We don't know when that's going to happen, Newton told the board, but whenever it does happen, it is going to be a huge expense for the district. Increasing the property tax levy would give the district flexibility in case of a tax cap or freeze. The median home price in the district is $77,500. For property owners of a home worth that much, property taxes would increase a little more than $4, taking the total bill from about $68 to $72. The district is scheduled to hear the proposal in more detail at its November 16th meeting. And from the opinion page, an editorial by James A. Hout. Many struggles won religious freedom. Freedom of religion means that nobody, not the government nor the surrounding culture, can tell you what to believe. All people are free to reach their own conclusions about faith. A little over a week ago, we marked International Religious Freedom Day on October 27th, so it's a good time to ponder the many, many battles that won this precious right. In past centuries, religious wars, persecutions, and cruelties were common. Crusades against Muslims, Reformation wars between Catholics and Protestants, pogroms against Jews, Inquisition tortures of nonconformists, witch hunts, eradication of Anabaptists, bloody jihads, etc. History is full of horrors. Physician scholar Michael Servetus, who discovered the pulmonary circulation of blood, was burned at the stake in Calvinist Geneva in 1553 for doubting the Trinity. His own books were used for his pyre. Philosopher-scientist Giordano Bruno was burned in Rome in 1600 for teaching that the universe is infinite, with many stars that might be accompanied by planets. The Enlightenment gradually changed Western civilization, instilling a new sense that faith is personal, not to be dictated by authorities. It slowly bred the separation of church and state, forbidding the use of government force to impose beliefs. But many struggles were required to achieve it. Here's an example. When Quakers first began expressing their beliefs in the 1600s, England's ruling Puritans denounced and persecuted them. Many fled to the New World, unfortunately, to Puritan Massachusetts, where they were persecuted anew. Massachusetts law required that all residents attend Puritan worship. In 1658, the Massachusetts legislature decreed that Quakers must be banned on pain of death. Quakers, arriving by ship, were seized and jailed, and their books burned. But Quakers stubbornly defied expulsion, returning repeatedly to hold worship services in homes. Persecution intensified. Quaker resistance finally forced a showdown. In 1659, three unrepentant Quakers, Marmaduke Stevenson, William Robinson, and Mary Dyer, were tried on capital charges and sentenced to death. The two men were hanged in Boston Commons on October 27, 1659, but the woman was reprieved and banished. However, she stubbornly returned to defy the Puritan law and was hanged in 1660. The following year, a fourth Quaker, William Ledra, also was hanged. By this time, some Massachusetts Puritans became revolted by their colony's cruelty and tried to soften Quaker punishments. In 1661, King Charles II ordered the colony to halt executions. He sent a royal governor who passed a Toleration Act allowing some believers to hold unorthodox beliefs. It was a breakthrough for freedom of religion. Peaceful acceptance of all sorts of religious views is central to democracy. Separation of church and state was locked into the First Amendment of America's Bill of Rights. Virginia's historic Statute for Religious Freedom, written by Thomas Jefferson in 1777 and finally passed in 1786, declares that no man shall be compelled to frequent or support any religious worship, place, or ministry whatsoever, nor shall be enforced, restrained, molested, or burthened in his body or goods, nor shall otherwise suffer on account of his religious opinions or belief, but that all men shall be free to profess and by argument to maintain their opinions in matters of religion. By coincidence, the first Boston Quakers were hanged on October 27th, the same calendar date that skeptic Michael Servetus was burned in Geneva. So this date eventually was adopted for International Religious Freedom Day, one of many observations little known to the public. Here's another religious freedom breakthrough. During the patriotic fervor of World War II, some Jehovah's Witnesses in West Virginia enraged neighbors because they refused to salute the flag and wouldn't let their children do so in public schools. They said their religion required them to swear allegiance only to God. Witness children were expelled from school for their unpatriotic behavior. But the American Civil Liberties Union fought their case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled in favor of the children in a famed 1943 decision, West Virginia State Board of Education versus Barnett. The court said personal beliefs are beyond the reach of majorities and officials, Justice Robert H. Jackson wrote eloquently. If there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word or act. Today, freedom to believe as one wishes is locked securely in the heart of democracy. And we'll go now to the A3 briefs for today from the local page. Effingham. Driver dies in crash. An Altamont man died after a single vehicle accident at 4:44 a.m. Saturday on U.S. 40 in Effingham County. Illinois State Police said Donald Verdayen, 63, was eastbound when his auto went off the roadway to the left and continued to travel east along the north ditch of the road. The sport utility vehicle Verdayen was driving came to rest in the north ditch of U.S. 40, just west of County Road 1075 East. Verdayen was pronounced dead at the scene at 5:05 a.m. Effingham County Coroner Dwayne Guffey said autopsy results are expected within 8 weeks. From St. Elmo, pedestrian killed. A man walking along the road to get help near St. Elmo after crashing his car was struck and killed by another vehicle early Saturday morning, Illinois State Police reported. Gregory Stoner, 50, of St. Elmo, was pronounced dead at the scene at 3:56 a.m. by Fayette County Coroner Bruce Bowen. Stoner had been struck at 3:01 a.m. while walking west on U.S. 40 near the intersection with County Road 2050 East. The vehicle that collided with him was driven by Ashley Lakin, 22, of Brownstown. Police said she suffered minor injuries after swerving to try to avoid Stoner and overturning her car in a ditch. The crash remained under investigation Sunday, and an autopsy will be performed. And this ends the first half of our reading from the Decatur Herald and Review. Stay tuned for the second half. We will return shortly.
Hello,